The forums tonight and tomorrow night are a chance for us to explore some of the crucial issues that confront the global church, some of the crucial issues that will be discussed in a part of a lively agenda in Vancouver starting next week. They are also issues that engage the members of the International Advisory Board and the staff of the Plowshares Institute. It's not coincidental that the Vancouver issues and the Plowshare issues mesh. The people around the fireplace here are people who are themselves deeply engaged in the ecumenical church on those issues. Now the topics for tonight's forum and tomorrow night's forum are, respectively, education for the non-poor and human rights. And the way we're going to organize it is as follows. Bob Evans, who is director of the Plowshares Institute and, you can tell by his shirt, the village philosopher for the next 2 weeks here at Holden, will moderate the forum, introduce you to Plowshares briefly, and then invite some brief statements from some of the board members on the issue for tonight on education for the non-poor. And then tomorrow night, Alice Evans, also then research director for Plowshares, will do a similar thing in moderated form when other members of the advisory board will address the question of human rights. What we would like to do is spend about 20 to 30 minutes maybe hearing from Plowshares, and that will give us at least half the time for an open exchange. Compline, the worship service at day's end is in here at 10:15, and we will take a break there, and you're invited to stay if you wish. Bob?
Thank you, Larry. I must never speak sitting down like this, but with a shirt like mine, in disappointment, it seems more appropriate. Delighted all of us are to be with you in the life of the Holden community, and we want just to share some of our perspectives and concerns. And Plowshares Institute builds well, I think, on the work that Paul Hansen was doing this morning, working on Isaiah. And from that second chapter, you will know the roots of the name of the Institute itself. And that is from that second chapter of Isaiah, where it says, "And God will judge between the nations, and that they will pound their swords into plowshares, their spears into pruning hooks, and that nation shall not lift up sword against nations, neither shall they study war anymore." Simply put, the Institute is committed to education and research for a more just, sustainable, and peaceful world community. We believe that at the heart of the Old and New Testament, and is reflected in many of the values here at Holden Village. But why do we? Let me tell you a story, an image. And you will learn this week, I really like the stories better than the 3 points and the poem, anyway. And the kind of story is an experience that did happen to me several months ago when I'd been in Washington, D.C. doing some work. And it was one of those nights, maybe some of you have gone through, either with accompanying parents or on your own, where you go on to the airport late at night, the plane's already delayed an hour, the rain is coming down, and they announce it's another hour delay, and you're in the airplane on the runway. Not exactly enthusiastic about the experience. And I've been talking to my colleague next to me, and it's the result of the delay, because I was a little worried about, you know, it was going to be one of those isolated trips. I was just going to stay to myself and go home. And I noticed he was looking at all kinds of things. We talked a little bit about our children and our family with each other. And suddenly it was denounced that the flight would stop in Rhode Island, in Providence, on the way home to Hartford. My heart was not lifted. Forced more into conversation with him. I noticed he was studying a lot of technical documents. And so I leaned over and said, "Those are interesting, as my daughters tell me I'm not very good with scientific things." And I asked him what all those were. And he said, "Oh, well, this is kind of some scientific material And I said, oh, is it classified? We always want to know if it's classified. He said, no, no, it's not. You see, I'm a weapons designer for the Pentagon. And this is a design for a new nuclear weapon that we will use when we have the nuclear war. And I said, you mean if we have a nuclear war? And he said, no, it's only a question of when and where. We have always used every weapon we've developed, and we have every intention of using this one. And I said, how do you feel about your children that we just talked about when you say that? And he said, I try not to think about it at all. And he said, by the way, what have you been doing in Washington? And I said, I've been meeting with a group of military officers on issues of peace and justice in the next decade. And he turned to me and he said, thank God, I hope you succeed. Somebody better so that I can give up this crazy profession and our children. But he said, until you do, I'm holding off the war one more day, one more month, one more week by what I'm doing. We've got to find an alternative. I made that night a friend. We talked a little, and we wept a little, and we saw somehow the hope in the hope of our children, a possibility for awakening. Now, simply, Plowshares Institute is trying to work on education for those of us who are the non-poor, who are those who are like the two of us. And we're looking for some way to relate with more courage and more direction to what is ahead of us. And therefore, in that passage is not from Isaiah just about disarmament. Because as I learned and was reminded by my friend Bob Brown, out of the roots of John, Pope John the 23rd and Reinhold Niebuhr, there was one common agreement, and that is the path to peace is ultimately found in the struggle for justice. And it is in the roots of those causes of justice to which Plowshares is key. Let me tell you one other analogy before we tell a little bit about what it means. And that is, as one of my daughters who's in college, just graduated from high school, going to college next year, reminds me I'm terrible with statistics as well as scientific diagrams. And see, I'm never very good when I deal with all those different images and statistics about the world. But one of the things that's clear is the world is being increasingly divided up between what we call the first world and the third world, or the north or the south, or the developed and the developed, whatever language you want to use. And one of the things that helps me is a kind of analogy for that, that may help you as well, and that is to envision the world as a global village of 100 people. I don't know how many people are in here tonight, Larry. 100? 50? 50? Okay, well, cut our statistics. Let's imagine that we are that global village. And if it were true that we were a global village of 50 people, for just a moment, imagine that, and what would it look like? Now, I want to take for just a minute, this is a kind of third of the room right there. I want to ask you to stand up. Will you stand up for me? It's a participatory evening. Actually, it's only a trick to keep you awake. On back to the corner. No, you can say you've got another role playing. All the way back in the corner, up and at them. That's right, that's a one-third, about one-third of that room. And if we were a third of the balcony, how about that crew right there? That would make a third. Up and at them. Is that some of the Holden miners right there? Okay. Third of the room, you are, in the statistics of the global community, the prosperous, the
Well, come to just like you are. How do you feel about that? When I do that for Rotary clubs, they applaud. Sit down. The rest of you stand up now. Come on down out here. Over on this side, that's the other two-thirds. You represent the two-thirds of the global village that is desperately poor. Most of you will go to bed every night hungry. One-third of you will be significantly malnourished. And that row, starting right there and going to the first post, will starve to death before the year's out. Think about that for a minute. And over half of you will be less than 12%. Now look at your friends in the one-third of the world. That's right, friends. On whom that situation exists. Sit down. This half of the room will make you stand up. This one half of the room will be illiterate, having no education at all. And out of the 100, one person. Larry, your turn. Stand up. Only one person will have a college education. Only one in that entire bunch. And out of the context of that one-third that has radically inadequate housing or shelter of any kind, we begin to picture the global village. Now, out of that global village of 100, six will be Americans. Let me just take the crew next to me.
You know what's coming.
Those six right there, right around, and including our first friend. Stand up for them. Six of those will be Americans, who by statistical standards will suffer none of the impairments of hunger and deprivation that the rest of that two-thirds we identified before will discover. Yet those six will consume 40% of all the products that come to the global village. They will also grow 18% of all the food, almost all of which they will consume themselves, except for what they store or destroy to raise the price of what you buy on the world. Now the question is, how are these six going to live peaceably with the other 94 members of the village? Maybe what they will do is arm themselves to protect what they have and spend twice as much per person on armaments as this two-thirds of the room gets in total income for you. Thank you. That's the global village in which we live, which none of us intended, and our experience in Plowshares is it's one in which most Christians no longer want to live. But those problems over often seem threatening and overwhelming, and they don't know where to take the first step. So Plowshares believes that there are ways, when especially Christians become aware of it, that they can take the first step in faithful response when this two-thirds of the world cries out for what is rightfully theirs by God's creation. We use three forms of that. One is a traveling seminar where we are invited by our colleagues in Africa and Asia and Latin America to come and live with them simply, directly, and understand their lives. And it transforms the people that go. Mm-hmm. Second, that's the learning
our gift from them. Second, we try to do seminars in local congregations and with church bodies, synods, presbyteries, and conferences, which are initially non-threatening, so people don't simply close off the discussion and not go any further. You know how it's like in those churches? Where you have that one small group of crazies that goes from issues of war and peace to issues of hunger, and most of the people never touch it. We've got to find a faithful entry point where people can hang in there long enough to hear God's word and to begin to respond faithfully. We're discovering it happens. And finally, we give one-third of our time in the service of our brothers and sisters in the third world overseas and the third world right in our midst to share our resources. And that's what ClassShares is about. And let me ask some of my colleagues, a few of them here tonight, to speak out of their concerns of that strategy of education among whom. Bill Kennedy, working many years at the World Council in Geneva on issues of education for a group called Atlantans for International Education, and now resides at Union Seminary. Well,
let me say two things. First is, later this week, I'm going to have a couple of sessions that we'll schedule as the week goes along on the World Council of Churches. If you're an interested church person, you belong probably to one of the Lutheran churches that's a member church. If you're interested in it, then you probably have all kinds of questions you would like to raise. From those 6.5 years on the staff, and from my general familiarity with the World Council of Churches, I want to have a kind of open session. You can talk to somebody who's been in the inside of it. And the title of the sessions I put up on the board, the World Council of Churches, Bane or Blessing? ? So I hope you'll all take advantage of the chance to have at it. What's it all about? What's it trying to do? Why does it get such criticism and so forth? In my work teaching education to future ministers at Union Seminary and in ClassShares, in ClassShares Institute, I try to raise the question, why is it with all the energy we put in education in the church that we do not produce a stronger prophetic church? Why is it that the value systems of our society seem so much stronger than the education of the body of people in the church, so that we are not able to bring a critical kind of Christian understanding of what's at stake in this world of human beings made by God as we try to do our Christian witness day by day? Now, in ClassShares Institute, we're trying to get at that question through a search for some models that seem to be offering some promise. Bob's mentioned one or two. And the project we're trying to plan here in our meeting this week is for a consultation in November in California, which will bring together 5 or 6 or 7 or 8 models of activities that people and groups are doing in different parts of the country, of which the travel seminars is one, where we try to say, what are you doing? Describe your educative action activity to us. And then bring in some consultants, including Paulo and Elsa Freire from Brazil, and ask, what are the things in this that seem to work, that we ought to try more and more in church education in a lot of places? What are the things that don't seem to work, and why don't they work better? And we'll publish a book that Orbis Books will publish in sometime next year, we hope, from these case studies, these stories of efforts to develop that kind of education, and the critique of it, which we hope will help it be useful to many people like those of us in this room who try to do activities that will change the bad parts of our world and our society, and that will help the church get a stronger muscle to do something for its Lord about those issues. So that's what we're doing here this week, and that's what we'll be up to in that particular project in November. That's the part of it that I'm most involved in now.
Thank you. feather of my colleagues, and you will get introduced to part of them tonight, is our advisory group. And that's Sister Maria Castanillo from the Sisters of Notre Dame de Moore. You can see our diversity, Presbyterian, Roman, we'll keep warming it up as we go along. Teaches at Emmanuel College in Boston, is a sociologist primarily, and works in inspirational ways for me by an earlier publication of a book of called A Sociotheology of Letting Go. Not terribly good at letting go, but it's the kind of issue. Marie?
I belong to a group who work in many different parts of the world, and our special work is teaching the very, very poor. And along with many other missionary people over the last 100 years, we've taught more and more the rights of the poor to the possession of the land. In fact, we've done it so well that beginning about 1950, it became evident that the poor, reflecting biblically on their rights to the land, have been organizing to claim their rights as human beings. But something happens when they do that. What happens is that the non-poor, and I will define the poor as groups of people who have high infant mortality rates and low life expectancy. What happens is the non-poor hold on to the things that the poor need and say that they belong to them because they bought them, they possessed them, they paid for them. And yet, biblically, the land belongs to the people who need it to stay alive. But that creates a problem with the ideas about private property, government ownership, multinational corporations, etc. So after a while, or very recently really, we phrased the question, when the poor reach out to take what is rightfully theirs, what does the gospel mandate the non-poor to do? And we answer it theoretically by saying, to take our grasp off the things that the poor need in order to survive. Now, that makes the gospel much more exciting good news for the poor, because the good news for the poor is that the land is theirs. But this doesn't sound like very exciting news to the non-poor. Now, what I found out as a sociologist, and I'm not going to discuss this tonight, but I will discuss it on Thursday morning, is that the situation of resources and people have radically changed since 1950, and I think I can demonstrate that in about 5 minutes, but I'm not going to do it tonight. And that as a result of that radical change, the whole question of what to do about the problems that Bob and Will and I are describing now has changed. And I think it's changed this way. We used to, as Christians, as our social action, say that we were concerned about alleviating the results of poverty. And the radical change is now we are concerned about eliminating its causes. Now, if you think about that for a minute, a very different agenda. The other agenda remains, but this one is there. Now, what gives us this any kind of dynamic energy to do this? Well, I'm going to speak of it theologically now, even though I'm a sociologist, because this is a forum, and I can be challenged. But a few years back, when I was teaching at Harvard Divinity a group of the doctoral candidates asked the faculty to come to a room and to tell them, one by one, who God is. Do you remember this, Paul?
Yes, I do.
So they lined us all up, and we had, beginning, Gordon Kaufman was first, because I remember, and I think Paul was second, and then Jim Powell was third, and we went around, and so when it became my turn, I was a visiting faculty member, so I was at the end. I said, I don't think I can tell you who God is, but I can tell you where God is. And everybody got all excited because that was better than nothing. So I said, God is with the poor as they reach out to take what is rightfully theirs. And everybody kind of agreed that that was so. So to take that theologically, I'll read the way I've stated and then you can do something with it. Inherent in our developing understanding of mission is the belief that God, who speaks to us in diverse ways, calls to us today with special insistence through the voices of the poor and the dispossessed as they seek to organize themselves to claim their rights as human beings. So what our project really is about is how we find God there in some kind of way that is credible and exciting in our lives.
Francis Kennedy on my right is related to Will. is a person who comes to the Institute with enormous numbers of contacts, and I will go through all the places in the world and activities she's been into as a volunteer laywoman. But two of the areas that seem to me most important are conversations with the issues of the community of men and women in the church and all that that implies. And second, as one in actively involved in Church Women United, raising the issue of corporate responsibility and the church's relationship to multinational corporations.
I am a woman, and I don't have any idea that women are better than men. I think that, however, does not let us off the hook of being the best that we can be as women. And I'm aware of the situation of women out of my own experience. I had a very exciting time in Geneva, Switzerland, working with the Ecumenical Wives, who were from all over the world, and there was a lot of growing in that experience for me. We have a son, but we also have three daughters, and they have certainly challenged and supported me as I've gone along. And so my ears prick up, you know, whenever I hear anything dealing with the women issue. And it's been exciting to watch what's happened in the World Council of Churches network, which is, you know, all of you, wherever you may be in local churches, all up to the bishops. And the women who have participated in the World Council meetings have become aware that they're a very small percentage of the people. And yet there's so many women in the local churches that the percentage at the decision level is hardly appropriate considering the participation at the local level. And out of this dialogue that's been going on, some more or less professional women got together in the 70s and analyzed what was going on and made some input. And then a woman was called to pull together a broader study. And the study was really not from the top, but some women formed the questionnaire and sent it out all over the world. And very local women's groups got together and began to discuss what is the community of women and men in the church. What is it? What should it be? You know, what might it be? And it's this that I want to discuss with whoever, you know, is interested in it on Saturday afternoon. I'd like to get your reflections on, get your experience, and then put that together with some of the study and research that I've done, and actual statements and that came out of the 1981 conference that the World Council held in Sheffield, England. That was the first conference that the World Council had ever had that had more women than men participants. And it was quite an interesting dynamic that took place. There was good research done before, good input, and I think some exciting things have come out of that. And it's still bubbling along, and you, some of you may know more about it than I do, but I need to learn from you, and I hope we'll have a chance to discuss it in some depth later on.
Just to say that this, you can see that you got part of the group tonight, and that's why we have our own particular feast of life. When we get together, discovering this community and others as a gift of God to us, just a few others that are here that you'll meet over the sessions, and hear tomorrow night from as we start these dialogues. Would be Bob Brown. You heard him in a conversation with Mo tonight by phone. It is Robert sitting right next to him, and he will also be talking tomorrow evening at 7 o'clock about a new work that he's done about families out of the Black tradition and the important learnings that have come out of that study. Nancy Hajek, you heard from on China. Or some of you did earlier in the afternoon. Henry Wilson, some of you may have heard Henry from India and Bangalore talking earlier in the evening about revolution in Asia. Al Evans, you'll also meet. Who have I missed around there? Some other colleagues, only mention Orlando Costas, Hispanic theologian. John Mbidi, African theologian. Kosuke Koyama, Asian theologian, are part of our colleagues who are on other assignments and can't be with us at the moment, but that's our crew, and we'd be delighted to have some dialogue and conversation with you, particularly with those Holden Miners up at top, about whether anything we've said expressing our own concerns and convictions ring any bells with you. Oh, I should say we have one crazy Luther on our International Advisory Council too, Larry Rasmussen. But I suspect you have to hear from him regularly, and we won't impose that on you in the next 2 nights. Question, comment, what, Paul?
Yeah, Bob, I'm terribly heartened to meet a group that talks to chief executives of corporations and politicians and don't come raving mad and shouting cheap slogans. Because I think that these corporations and governments are here for a long time and Christians have to work with them and be part of them. Can you tell us a little bit more about this effort to relate to executives of multinational corporations, government heads, and the like? Maybe Frances is the one to answer that. You mentioned specifically that she has been working with corporate heads. Was that just in the church, Frances? But you see the drift of my question. I'm terribly concerned that the church affect positions of power.
I'm on the board of the Interfaith Center on Corporate Responsibility, but so is Larry. So we'll share this one. It's been an exciting adventure for me because when you're talking about the non-poor, most of us are pretty heavily involved in the economic system of the United States, those of us here. And whether it's a little savings account we have or whether we have shares in some of these major corporations. But certainly the organizations we belong to, the institutions we belong to, have heavy investments. Endowments or simply the running funds are intimately related with these corporations. So out of this has grown a sense of responsibility about what those corporations do or don't do, and how, if we're going to invest our money in them, should we have any input at all on the moral and ethical things that they may be doing? And this, the group of people, comes from all over, all the churches, the Catholic orders, all send representatives to meet regularly. We usually meet in the several meetings in the fall when we put together what we have learned about things that are going on and how, and decide which companies we would like to dialogue with. And then the institution, and I work closely with Church Women United, and we have certain issues that mean a great deal to us. You know, how women are treated and how minorities are dealt with and so forth. So on the basis of that, we will understand that a certain company is doing certain things, and instead of making a lot of fuss about it, we contact the company and we say, we're concerned, can we talk about this? And usually we have a rather meaningful conversation about it. If we feel that we're not getting the answers to the questions that we're raising, or we're being put off in some way, then we will perhaps form a resolution to take to the annual meeting. And at that annual meeting, then we have a chance to present our position and to get response from the other people there, the board of directors and so forth. And depending on how the reaction goes to that, we might be able to come back again and raise that question the next year and so forth. And we think we make a great difference. The corporation seem to appreciate the fact that we want to be in conversation with them. And we more often than not reach some accommodation on that, and don't have to go through the resolution process.
Thank you, Frank.
Harry, do you want to add? Say one side word, Paul. We're also planning in 2 years a traveling seminar for chief executive officers of multinational corporations, in which two of those chief executive officers are initiating it, and that would mean living in villages among a variety of people in Brazil and Nicaragua, meeting with the guy. And most of those people usually go and live in the local Hilton and are taken around by their confession, by the representatives of their corporation in that country that want them to see one thing. We're confident that might make some difference, and they are both excited and terrified about the possibilities. But I think there are some ways to work on that that you all other lines. Other could be statements as much as questions, please.
I have Holly? A question for Sister Marie, if that's how you should be addressed. I don't even know for sure how to say that. Why is it that the issue of justice seems to be an identification of God as the core? Why is it that that seems to be a renewed image? For example, I became a Christian about 6 years ago, and I didn't get full liberation theology, certainly, out of our local Methodist church, but all of a lot, I read the Bible and I see peace and justice issues just glaring on every page. And then I look at some of the people in the churches that were raised with American civil religion, I guess you'd call it, and it's like we're worshiping two different gods almost. Mm-hmm. Why are these issues now becoming so clear?
Well, in the part of my little presentation tonight, I said that there have been some radical changes in the mid-20th century that make some problems which we thought prior to this time were not solvable problems, solvable. Well, and the problems I'm talking about are problems like the that you described in the global village, the radical uneven distribution of the world's wealth. Now, in the past, we had poverty and we didn't have international communication, therefore we could never get an image of the world and its resources, or any deep understanding of whether, in fact, there was enough to go around. And beginning about in the middle of the 19th century, we had a movement, and actually it began as a church movement, that we were going to run out of food and have too many people. and it was Malthus who was his minister. His solution was not to marry until it was very late, so that there would be fewer people. And then the neo-Malthusian began in the around 1940 to say, well, we'll do it some other way, but we will have what's called a lifeboat ethic. That is, we'll be very practical about the whole thing and say there isn't enough food, but we must take care of our own first. And we began defining our own as people who looked like us, had access to the same resources, and we co-opted the church, we captured it. There was a book that Gibson Winter wrote in 1960 called The Suburban Captivity of the Churches. And most of us came to the United States as immigrants, we all did, unless there are a few Indians here. We came to the United States as immigrants, and we took over pieces of land. And we struggled very, very hard with them. And our church usually came with us. And that church helped us to have an identity. And the way of government and the way of life in the United States made us feel that the church and the state somehow went together in such a credible way. So we didn't notice the other people coming in. And we felt we had worked hard for what we got, and therefore they ought to do the same thing. But it became evident. We said they should work hard, they should be thrifty, hard working and initiated the way we were. But what became evident in the mid-20th century is that when they did that, that's when we began to resist them. When they did organize, when they did reach out, when they did the non-lazy thing, the initiating thing. In fact, in Brazil, when they learned how to read and write very, very fast, we went in and overthrew the government. And so we had to begin thinking that without realizing it, we were creating a serving class and justifying it biblically. And I guess the best example of that is apartheid in South Africa. It's a model, it's not way over there, because it's going to be used too. Well, in any event, my field is sociology, and sociology of religion, the analysis of what religion is actually doing, really only came to a point where we could really understand the question you raised very recently. But one of the things that made it easier for us to understand it is that access to resources changed. So there were what seemed an unsolvable problem became a solvable one. And I think that the excitement is now that we can read those biblical passages, and instead of translating them into private agenda, we let them be what they are. And that's what we'll talk more about. It's a very important question.
A hand over here. A moment ago.
I would like to backtrack a little bit. In the dialogue with the corporation, could we have some more specifics on that? What kinds of things are you dealing with that sifts down to the people that you're attempting to help? And for want of a better word, what kind of clout do you have?
Well, just to be honest, you say very little.
How do you affect change?
Well, I think we try to make our constituencies aware of the problem, and we develop public opinion about that situation, which is far beyond changing the, getting enough stockholder vote to make the company do something differently. And
as it happens,
it would help to deal to be more specific, I think, and I don't know how much familiarity you have with it, but I can give it, from Church of the United, it probably helped more to get you a Lutheran, what the Lutherans have taken stands on, but their concerns, like in South Africa, situation, you see that, how do we impact South Africa? Well, we do, because it's the United States corporations, United States-based corporations, that are developing and making a lot of money in South Africa off of cheap labor. And so we try to get the corporations, for instance, last year it was Xerox. We tried to get the corporation to say that they simply would not increase their business that they would not sell Xerox equipment to the military and the police. You know, it's clear that it's the development of companies like that enable the police and the military to control the situation in South Africa. Okay, well, I see some other hands. Go ahead with the questions then.
Can I give an example for you? Corporation, so WCP or Nestle's baby food formula, you know, that's the one where it has, I think where churches have come up and effective changes in the Nestle's baby food formula.
Well, we have a work group called International Health, and the Nestle situation comes under that. In other words, we take the companies that are really affecting negatively health situations, whether it's Nestle or whether it's a drug corporation. And you know, in the United States, we have certain laws that about what can be sold here. But the companies here who make drugs that can't be sold in the United States have to get rid of them. So where do they go to sell them? They go to the third world. Or where is the worst place they could possibly sell them? In the third world, where they don't have the same restrictions on the medications you can buy. And so you can walk into any pharmacy, and well, the equivalent of the pharmacy, and you can buy a drug that you would not be able to buy in the United States without a doctor's prescription. And so they're not only being dumped on the third world, it's much more hazardous situation for selling them than in the United States. So that whole international health thing is broader than the Nestle, how the infant formula is you know, so is pushed onto people, so that the Nestle is such a clear one, because it happens so instantaneously. If a woman in the hospital is not encouraged or allowed or what have you to nurse her baby, then she does not have that option any later. And so it's just the first few days or the first week when the baby is given infant formula, that then that precludes the nursing, which gives the baby the immunization and the nourishment that you can never get when you don't have enough formula later on.
I see three hands. Falls up here, one back here, and right over here.
We kind of go in that order, if that's okay, and we all get it.
Let me say this too. This is a very, very a broad thing we're talking about. You know, it goes in so many different directions, and I see so many hands, and I wonder how much we're going to do with it. I think it would help if we set up a session, and if those who are particularly interested in that could come. I certainly would be glad to meet with them.
Why don't we work on posting that at a time later this week?
Yeah.
That's not to cancel the questions already out there.
Mm-hmm.
Only to say this gives us another chance to work on that directly. Larry, does that sound possible? Paul?
Our Lutheran families have, their churches have been struggling with the issue of divestment of our investments in South African involved. Corporations, you know, where we put the money of the church for pension funds and all those things. Those sick people over there, you know, are they going to be putting that money, your families, our families, and our church, in those corporations? Does the Plowshares Group have guidance out of their studies and educating us of our several denominations for the pros and cons of divestment as a policy of the church? So I'd be interested in your response to that.
Thanks to speak to that.
I could just speak briefly. On the South African question, I was in South Africa in 1970. At that time, Honeywell was just coming to South Africa. IBM was there already. Now, the reason they were coming is that South African government was very eager to try out any kind of electronic equipment that would make the need of hand labor minimal. Now, South African government has 72% of its population is black that does the hand labor, and by law must do it. Well, if Honeywell comes in, they don't need that labor anymore. They have a system there that the black population really has only 18% of the land, 15% of the land that they have a right to live on. That land is all out in the country, and it's in areas that are very poorly, there are no farms, there are no railroads, there are no equipment there. And when they live in near the city, they have to have a job in the city. When they don't have a job in the city, for a certain amount of time, they have to go back to their homeland. Well, if you have a lot of electronic equipment that doesn't need people, they're not going to need their population anymore. And that population, which is really the main population of South Africa, has no vote, has no right to own land, has no rights in the country, even though it's their country. Now, when a company, a United States company, goes and invests in a kind of industrial development that's going to make it less possible for the people of that country to live, that's a violation of their basic rights. And so what, by the divestment, one of the companies you'd want not to invest in would be a company whose intent was to increase, to decrease the uses of people in industry. Unless you know the structure of South African country, what you ought to learn in church, really, because it's a totally unjust structure. There's nothing that justifies it. But learning it in the context of a church setting, you can really come to some grips with understanding our nation of people. But for some reason that we can also explain, churches are quite uncritical, or have been, where their money is invested. In fact, very few Americans take responsibility when they buy stocks or when they bank their money. What is done with it? And what the churches have done is help to make us conscious of the uses of money and help us to make decisions as to what the good things are to invest in. For example, the Jobs for Peace movement in the United States to convert the military industry into peaceful uses. There's a lot of work that has to be done. Young people have to understand those things, get enthusiastic about them, and join. Give their talents to the right companies, or move their companies to change. And South Africa is one of the best examples of really an explosive structure in the church of work.
I think the best education, if I understand what's happening in the Lutheran world right now, is the experience of the church in Namibia. And that's a direct feedback from the mission efforts of the Lutheran world for a century, now giving first-hand experience of what's happening to Christian people down there in that situation. Now that always kind of feeds back through the World Council of Churches, through the Lutheran World Federation, through the American Lutheran Church, if I remember a year or so ago, in a direct way. And they cannot, from South Africa, legally, without being put in jail when they go back, say, you ought to divest. But if you get them where they're sure there's no bug, and where nobody else is listening, they will say, sure, it'll hurt the blacks in South Africa, but we know what it is to hurt already. It would be wise, it would help us most if you would divest. Now, how do you carry that out is the next sort of step. But I think those of you who have direct ties with people in Namibia are getting that kind of message with the same kind of directness behind the scenes that has been accumulating through the years of the apartheid system.
And one word, there's an exchange traveling seminar by Plowshares where there was a group coming from South Africa and East Africa last year to meet with multinational corporations and state representatives. That was organized by Desmond Tutu, the delegation of bishops in South Africa that came here, and there was among them a consensus that it will cause initial pain, but there must be a radical step to break toward liberation, and it is divestment. And even in the midst of that, they were arguing that for government, and that was an exchange out of a contact directly with us. So I would call in another hand, right, the gentleman right at the back.
To the lady on your right, do you honestly think that if Xerox didn't sell that computer that somebody else wouldn't and make the profit?
Well, that's probably we go
with I ask you a question now. Do you think that if Xerox didn't sell it to them, somebody else wouldn't? England or France or Russia or somebody else make a profit?
Well, I think that...
The golden rule says you always got the gold, makes the rules. You've got gold down there.
I think increasingly there are international connections that do impact this.
In other words, we'll be real quick.
Pardon?
The good one. Japanese would be glad to sell them on.
What's the implication?
Well, the implication is that I don't see any reason for jumping on Xerox for selling them on.
Would you extend that to arms?
Well, they can buy armaments most any place in the world.
Yeah. No, is the implication that the church ought not then to press the question of sales of equipment to the police and the military in South Africa because the Russians will sell them, or the Japanese, or the Germans? Is that the implication that you ought not to press it as a Christian?
Who's selling the armaments now? Probably our government. Do you want to stop our government?
Oh, plenty.
I'm a citizen.
No, I just want to explore it because I think it's a very important question.
No,
what is the implication of pointing out that it will be done by others?
Well, I mean, why not make the topic?
Yeah.
Well, aren't you giving them a job? You're giving them a job when you take something down there and they manufacture it. Who owns the land in Africa? And where would this country be if it were not for the corporations? Would we have money for research? Some little two before outfit? Absolutely not. We have the highest standard of living in the world. I have a personal friend that took a color slide presentation in Africa, and the French came in there and they improved their situation where they had water and wells and so on and so forth. And what happened? The population increased and the land will not support them. What are you going to do? You're going to let them start?
Well, could I respond to that? The first question when you said,
Well, I asked you first, yeah. Who owns the land in Africa?
The question before that.
Corporation.
Well, do we take anything of the corporations? I think that's the question. Is it, do we justify anything?
Were they better off before we came in?
Yeah, I remember your question.
Because
what you said
you're
was,
giving them a job.
Well, see, no, what I try to explain is you're not giving them a job. If you send down the companies that don't need workers, you're not giving them a job. That's the important issue. I mentioned the companies that deal with automation. You're not giving them a job, and that they have an enormous population that needs jobs. So that's no advantage. You're giving them a means of production where you don't need people. The second thing, and you ask who owns the land in Africa, because it's different from country to country, but in South Africa, 87% of the land is owned by the white population, which is 18% of the people. And by law, that land cannot be owned by either black, colored, or Asian. That's what the apartheid system is. And your third question, they'll simply increase and multiply and fill the land. That's the question I'm going to work on Thursday morning. I think there's a lot of information on what's happening to the world population that we should know about, because it isn't increasing that way.
This gentleman, I seem to be asking too about divestment and whether it really does set up as an absolute target every corporation, American corporation with investments in South Africa. I know the Harvard policy on divestment has three stages. And the first is to confront companies with their labor policy in Africa, and if they are truly dedicated to increasing the proportion of black workers, I think Ford was one instance that they worked on, then they don't advocate divestment. So that's not that absolute across-the-board policy. Is yours nuanced in that way, or is it strictly divestment of all stocks and all companies involved in any way in South Africa?
Well,
Well, the remark that I was making was not, and I ought to be clear about that, not a representation of research of Plowshares Institute per se. I was commenting on a group.
I heard that, but I'm asking about you now, because I think that gentleman is raising a legitimate point. You know, are you just against corporations in South Africa, or is it more nuanced than that? So I'd ask about Plowshares now.
I guess if I could respond to that directly, I would have to say that my dialogue with colleagues there, they would be willing to suggest that there are levels in which American corporations are responsible in their location and their action in South Africa. But when you are at the level of injustice and inhumanity, that is presently the case in South Africa, that the only way that appears apparent to them to begin to break that is with a radical statement on divestment. And they think that the distinctions of criteria, although rationally valid, tend to escape the radicality of the injustice to the majority of the South Africans. Now, that's how I'd answer it personally, but there...
There's just one point, Paul. In South Africa, the Ford Company cannot decide how many blacks it's going to hire. You hire in South Africa through a government labor pool. And if it's hand work, you hire black. If it's middle organization work, I mean middle foreman, you hire Asians and colored. And if it's administrative or white collar work, you hire whites. And you don't have a choice. And that's where the problem is. It's this basic kind of injustice. So you have four educational systems by law. Blacks are educated to do handwork. Colored and Asians have the middle jobs. And all the administrative jobs and clerical jobs have to go to whites. If you were a white and wanted to do the other jobs, you couldn't do them. And I think we have to understand the South African apartheid system. It's a very forthright, clear system. It simply says that people of different races cannot develop together, and in this country we will have separate education for each one, separate jobs for each one, and government control all in the hands of the white population. Even those of you that are reading about bringing the non-whites into government, it's Asians and colored. And Asians mean Indians. Japanese are honorary white because they developed Namibia, which South Africa has no right to. Now, I want to say these things because the reason why the people who are dealing with divestment concentrate on South Africa is because it's basically unjust, but it's becoming a model for the United States. Those of you that work on inner city have seen that the condominium movement into the city is eliminating the housing areas where third world people live, and they're being forced out of the city, out of the edge of the cities, out of the unincorporated area, and they have the same model. And so South Africa is much closer to us than we realize, and we have to take very seriously that that's the problem.
I had a hand over here. Well, maybe we can move. What is clear to me as the village philosopher, and that was one of the things I was supposed to do, is not to suggest we're going to settle it all tonight, but that we're going to have some opportunities to stay in dialogue with each other. And that's very important. It would be a misconception that we don't believe there are a variety of viewpoints and roles for individuals and corporations and churches and communities, and a variety of perspectives reflected here, and we'll set and work on some agendas. Do I hear some interest in that? On other points during the week when we can come back to some of these, but I want to honor my going around to the hand.
Thank you very much.
I was there before, and sorry we got shortcut.
I will ask my question cue for some of you.
Thank you. but what is our the time? Is it that time?
I have about 5:10, so we can take 5 minutes and then we're off
first. Okay. So I'm right there.
This gentleman over here, I think he raised a point. I feel that there's been a contradiction of terms come out of this forum, because what was the purpose of these companies going into South Africa or other third or fourth or fifth world countries for? What was the purpose? It was cheap labor, right? and profits. But I mean, companies are in business for profit, but there was cheap labor. So now you're saying that these companies no longer hire the cheap labor that's there. So why are they earning that? I guess I'm confused about that. I don't understand what you're saying.
No, it's just one. I said the companies that are dealing with the development of electronic equipment get a lot of resistance from the unions in the United States, because by the very use of the company's materials, there are fewer jobs. South Africa is at one companies that are interested in fewer jobs. So you can't generalize from the company, electronic companies, to all other kinds of companies. It's a unique situation. And I gave the example of companies going there in 1970 and experimenting with getting leverage to experiment with their equipment because it's what South Africa wanted. So it's different from other companies, the electronic companies.
But I still, are they getting cheaper middle class and upper class labor?
They were resisted in the United States by the labor union, rightfully. And so they accepted an invitation to go someplace else, not to get cheaper labor, but to have a space where they could experiment with their electronic equipment.
Well, you have two problems here. In the instance that you introduced, you're talking about sales and immediate profit. In the case of Ford, you're talking about a factory where they manufacture.
What I'm talking about is generating a method of production that doesn't need workers.
Impossible. No, not impossible. This is a steel plant outside Pretoria in conjunction with a visit to the university there, and you walk into a large room and you look down the length of the building and you don't see.